All right, good evening, everyone. Welcome to Great Decisions, Part 26. It looks like, because of the vagaries of my schedule, the last one of the year, like every Monday night is full, we're discussing tonight the Reform Rebellion Patrilineal Dissent Decision of 1983, sponsored again by Becky Navikatz, Ilan Nishmas Yonim, and Rav Arya Leib, and I thank them for their sponsorship the whole year. And, hot off the presses, happy 50th anniversary to Seymour and Marcia Kay coming up this week. Hot off the presses.
I'm going to go buy a card.
You better buy more than a card after 50 years. Okay.
Good thing I reminded
you. Good thing I reminded. I have to keep track of these things. Well, one can easily maintain, without sounding too strident, that the Reform movement, the Reform Rebellion, began in the late 1700s with a rejection of the divine origin of Torah, the Tarshit Baal Peh, oral law, and its inevitable rejection of the primacy of mitzvos like Shabbos and Kashrus, Milah, etc. So much of it is well known, and the excesses are famous, including the early Reform change of Shabbos from Shabbos to Sunday, eliminating references to Tzion, Yerushalayim, so beyond the pale, and so imitative of German Protestantism that early Reform was in fact a natural feeder for the Protestants, and so beyond the pale that there was a natural backlash, and many communities over time have restored elements of Judaism, including references to Tzion, and putting Shabbos back on Shabbos, and other things as well. And even in recent times, they've tried to adopt more Jewish ritual to seem more Jewish. But in modern times, few acts have caused as much controversy and bore as much potential for schism as did the decision in 1983 to embrace patrilineal dissent. It was Reform Judaism's direct attack on Jewish identity, with grave consequences through which we're now living with no resolution in sight. It was one of those decisions that they felt was natural and justifiable, whose effects they may not have fully considered, but which was in essence reflective of the death throes of a movement. So how did it come about? What was its imperative? Granted, Reform is a non-halachic movement, but they nonetheless attempted, for reasons we'll discuss, to base their deviation on Jewish tradition, as illogical as it sounds. So on what was it based? How controversial was it even in the Reform movement? How did the conservative and Orthodox movements react to it? And until this day, how do we react to it? And what have been the long-term implications? So I think it's important that we start from the end and work our way backwards, and we'll clear up some misperceptions in the process. In essence, it was not really a patrilineal dissent decision. March 15th, 1983, the CCAR, Central Conference of American Rabbis, the Reform Rabbinical Group, adopted the following resolution, which was then put into effect in October of that year. I quote, "The Central Conference of American Rabbis declares that the child of one Jewish parent is under the presumption of Jewish descent. This presumption of the Jewish status of the offspring of any mixed marriage is to be established through appropriate and timely public and formal acts of identification with the Jewish faith and people. The performance of these mitzvahs serves to commit those who participate in them, both parent and child, to Jewish life." Think about what that means for a moment. We'll get back to it in 20 seconds. I continue the quotation. "Depending on circumstances," meaning determined by the rabbi based on age and other things, "mitzvahs leading toward a positive and exclusive Jewish identity will include entry into the covenant, acquisition of a Hebrew name, Torah study, bar bat mitzvah, Kabbalat Torah, confirmation. For those beyond childhood claiming Jewish identity, other public acts or declarations may be added or substituted after consultation with their rabbi," end quote, meaning flexibility was left. What this means, in effect, and I don't know if it's widely known, note the phrase, "the child of one Jewish parent is under the presumption of Jewish descent," presumption established through appropriate and timely public and formal acts of identification. It means the Reform did not simply supplement their definition of Jewish identity with patrilineality in addition to matrilineality, but they changed the definition entirely. Whereas the halacha traditionally accepts as Jewish the child of a Jewish mother, regardless of her level of observance, and even the absence of any observance or formal identification, the Reformer is stating here that even the mother's Jewishness is not enough. It's not enough. You need to have, if it's a mixed marriage, you need to have a public and formal act of identification with the Jewish people. What does it mean in effect? According to the Reform, so now we know, you heard last week, John Cardinal O'Connor was Jewish. His mother converted to Catholicism at age 19. Her parents are buried in the Jewish cemetery in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Is he Jewish according to us? Yes. Is he Jewish according to Reform? No. It's enough if either mother or father is Jewish, but what's critical is that there be some appropriate and timely public and formal act of identification. So according to the Reform, O'Connor would not be Jewish because neither his mother nor he undertook any public and or formal acts of identification with the Jewish faith and people, unless you count giving communion to Ed Koch. That's a sea change from our understanding of Jewish identity, and in theory, maybe even a sharper break than the patrilineal decision. So in practice, I can't imagine that it's enforced. In other words, that they would actually hold that the child of a Jewish mother is not Jewish as long as they don't embrace another religion. Of course, in practice, it might not matter because anyone who shows up at a Reformed temple, by definition, has performed an act of identification and faith with the Jewish people, even though they may have a Jewish mother or a Jewish father. But if you think about it, the ruling is astonishing. It's not just that even a non-Jewish father, or even a Jewish father suffices to convey identity. Even a Jewish mother is not enough to convey Jewish identity. I don't think that this is widely known. Why would they do that? Why would they seek to change and dilute Jewish identity and cause a schism in the Jewish people? And they were not unaware of what they were doing. In fact, exactly the opposite. So I quote from the decision. We are aware that we have made more stringent requirements than our tradition. We believe that this will lead to a firmer commitment to Judaism on the part of these individuals and that it will enable them to become fully integrated into the Jewish community. We have taken the step for the following additional reasons. One, we do not view birth as a determining factor in the religious identification of children of a mixed marriage. Birth matters not at all. Secondly, we distinguish between descent and identification. Of the two, identification is the criterion that matters most. End quote. So we'll return. Actually, I ended the quote before the commentary. The quote ends, we distinguish between descent and identification. So we'll return to the reasons, but in fact, there was a precedent for this distinction between descent and identification. In 1947, the CCAR adopted this resolution. They said, with regard to infants, the declaration of the parents to raise them as Jews shall be deemed sufficient for conversion. This could apply, for example, to adopted children. It means whatever the status of the parent is, if a parent comes along and says, I want this child deemed Jewish, then they would accept it. They don't need conversion. An adopted child, both Jewish parents, they come to the temple, they say, we want to register as a Jew, they would do that. In due course, it was applied to children generally, not just adopted children. In 1961, this policy was adopted. They said that Jewish law recognize a person as Jewish if his mother was Jewish, even though the father is not a Jew. One born of such mixed parentage may be admitted to membership in the synagogue, entered into marital relation with a Jew, provided he has not been reared in or formally admitted to some other faith. the child of a Jewish father, a non-Jewish mother, according to traditional law, is a Gentile. Such a person would have to be formally converted in order to marry a Jew or become a synagogue member. 1961, they concluded, Reform Judaism, however, accepts such a child as Jewish without a formal conversion. If he attends a Jewish school and follows a course of studies leading to confirmation, such procedure is regarded as sufficient evidence that the parent and the child themselves intend that he shall live as a Jew. If so, if the child of a non-Jewish mother can be accepted as a Jew without conversion, if he attends school and confirmation classes, I hate to call it reform school, because when I was young that had different connotation, but so what exactly was changed in 1983? And the answer is that nothing really, except the requirement of school or confirmation classes for anyone with one Jewish parent, and the complete equalization of father and mother in this equation. And that, they admitted, was inherently connected to another reform value, egalitarianism. Men and women are no different, period. Thus, I quote, the reform movement has espoused the equality of men and women virtually since its inception, as equality has been applied to every facet of reform Jewish life. It should be applied in this instance. End quote. Thus, patrilineal descent, in essence, was just another arrow in the quiver of egalitarianism, whose spirit is offended not only if men are treated as superior to women, but also if women are given a status superior to that of men, here in the transmission of Jewish identity. What also changed, of course, and this really was the motivation, in the interim between 1961 and 1983, was the explosion of intermarriage in the Reform world. I quote, we face today an unprecedented situation due to the changed conditions in which decisions concerning the status of a child of a mixed marriage are to be made. There are tens of thousands of mixed marriages. In a vast majority of these cases, the non-Jewish extended family is a functioning part of the child's world and may be decisive in shaping the life of the child. It can no longer be assumed a priori, therefore, that the child of a Jewish mother will be Jewish any more than that of a child of a non-Jewish mother will not be. The scales then were completely balanced. The patrilineal descent decision was nothing less than an attempt to assuage the feelings of the non-Jewish partner to the marriage, and to the child of a non-Jewish mother, who should not have to feel like a convert. He should feel as Jewish as anyone, so the decision arose out of necessity. Read that, lost membership, and reflected the basic reality that most marriages of Reformed Jews then were actually intermarriages, and overwhelmingly so today. It's the rarity today when two Reformed Jews marry each other. The decision was problematical, to say the least, obviously halachically, but also philosophically, but especially methodologically. And we'll see why. Notwithstanding, it's always, I mean, we mentioned a few times already this year, notwithstanding that Reformed Judaism categorically rejects the binding nature of halacha, as it does the divine origin of the Torah, the movement went to great lengths to justify its decision according to Jewish sources, even the Talmud, even the Poskim. We could certainly wonder why, if they reject halacha, why would they deem it necessary to prove their deviations are acceptable according to halacha, or according to Jewish tradition? So I speculate, but I think the answer is that for the self-definition, and to satisfy the emotional needs of some of their adherents, they do not want to be perceived as establishing another religion. Many Reform Jews, not most, are not only Jews, but they want to be perceived as Jews. Think into history. Just 19 centuries ago, another Jewish movement started, claimed fidelity to tradition, had some deviations. They were first perceived as just another sect of Jews. In short order, within one century, they were construed as a separate faith community entirely. That is to say, Christianity. Originally, it had all the makings of another Jewish sect. In time, in the second century, Chazal drew a line around them. through the Birkas Aminim and other ways, and it became clear that one could not be a Jewish Christian or a Christian Jew. You had to make a choice. So I think a conscious effort was made throughout the history of the Reform movement not to be perceived as a distinct religion. Hence, the determined effort to show that patrilineal descent can be supported within the tradition. As implausible as it sounds, it helps many Reformed Jews retain their self-definition as being part of a Jewish movement, notwithstanding the fact that many Reformed Jews today are not Jews, according to halacha, due to the prevalence of intermarriage and spurious conversions. So how did they decide? How did they attempt to justify it according to halacha? So we return to the protocols of the decision. In the decision, the Reform conceded that for at least 2,000 years, I quote, the Jewish identity of a child has been determined by matrilineal descent. The mother determines Jewishness. The Torah says, how do we know this? The Torah says in the prohibition of intermarriage, Velosis Chatein Bom, it's the end of Parshas Voschanan, Velosis Chatein Bom, you should not marry them, Bitcholos Itein Livno, Uvitalos Ikach Livnecho. Your daughter should not be given to their son, nor should their son be taken for your daughter. Not allowed to marry a non-Jew, male or female. If you do, the Gemara says in Kiddushin, Daf Samaches, Samet Beis, Lo Tofsi Be Kiddushe. There is no marriage. Marriage cannot be transacted. You know, technically, there's no such thing as an intermarriage, because there's no marriage. Marriage is impossible with a non-Jew. So what about the children? How do we know, Vlada Kamosa, that the offspring always follow the mother? Whence the offspring spring? Next pasuk. Because they will take your son away, lead your son astray. They'll worship other gods. God's anger will flare against you. He'll destroy you quickly. Note how the previous pasuk speaks of sons and daughters. But this pasuk only speaks of sons. Your son will be led astray. Why is that? Omar Yochanan Mishum Shim Ben Yochai. The Omar Kro. Ki Asir is Bincha Me'acharai. Your son will be led astray. Bincha Habami Yisraelis Kori Bincha. Your son that comes from a Jewish mother is your son. Ve'ein Bincha Habami Na'oved Eskochavim Kori Bincha Elabino. But a child that comes from a non-Jew, that's her child. That's not your child. So if your son marries a non-Jew, his offspring will be gone. They'll be lost. Ki yasir bincha me'acharai. As opposed to, if your daughter marries a non-Jew, then her children are still Jewish. So that's where the Torah distinguishes bitcha and bincha in one sense, but only beno in the next sense. Omer avino, shma mino, ben bitcha, habomen oved kochavim, koroi bincha. The child, the son of your daughter, non-Jewish father, he is still considered your son. In other words, matrilineal descent. A child of a Jewish mother is Jewish, the child of a non-Jewish mother is not Jewish. Now, does this ban on intermarriage apply only to the seven nations of Canaan? So, you hear this constantly, the Gemara rejects that. Hahu b'shiva goyim ksiv. Sharumos minolon. How do we know that it applies to other nations as well? Omar kro ki yasiris bincha larabos kolam esirim. If your son will be led astray, it's anyone who will lead him astray. Any other faith system, not just those of the seven Canaanite nations. So, how can this clear prohibition be negotiated? We have to get clever. So here they make three methodological mistakes that are completely in line with their approach to Judaism. First, so I said this is the Gemara Kiddushin, that's elsewhere in the Talmud as well. Rather than the Torah Shebaal Peh codifying what was the practice, that is to say, how we perceive Jewish identity since Sinai, instead they assume that the Gemara Kiddushin, En Yavamos, and elsewhere are enacting something new. That because the Gemara mentions it, therefore it must be a change that came into Jewish life at some time, And until that time, Jewishness was based on the status of the father. So in that, they're partially right. Identity was based on the status of the father, but only until Sinai, until the Torah was given. That's why it didn't matter who Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, the Shvatim, Moshe married, because the descendants of the ancients were part of the covenant. It was the fathers that conveyed the status to the members of the tribe. Identity was based on the status of the father. This changed at a certain point in history. Kabbalah Satorah. We got the Torah at Sinai. That's when it changed. Two points should be understood. Their misconception of the Torah Shebaal Peh completely distorts their understanding of Torah, as it must. So they assume that the oral law came much later, 15 centuries after Sinai. So until then, the practice was one thing, and then at the time of the Mishnah, they changed it. But that means they conflate the oral law with the transcription of the oral law, as if to say, until it was written down, it never existed. But of course, that can't be. How do we know it can't be? Well, that's why it's called the oral law, because it was oral. If it was just the Talmud, it wouldn't be oral, it'd be in writing. So this, of course, is false. Moshe Kibel Torah Mi-Sinai is not a reference to Torah Shebichsav, but a reference to Torah Shebaal Peh. Both were given to Moshe at Sinai. This is a cardinal principle of our faith. So, of course, if they reject the divine origin of Torah Shebichsav, it's not astonishing that they'll also reject the divine origin of the Torah Shebaal Peh. The second point along these lines is their confusion of tribal status with Jewish status. Tribal status, for as long as it was meaningful, part until today, before the tribes routinely began to intermarry during the period of the Shoftim, tribal status was conveyed through the father. That's this week's Sedra. Fragment you see again and again in the writings. How did Sedra begin? Second Pasuk. We'll count the Jews. L'mishpichosam, l'veisavosam, parshas b'midbar. According to their families, according to their father's homes. But being counted for the census is not the same as ascribing Jewishness. And this we see from elsewhere in the Torah. This was the problem of the blasphemer at the end of Parshas Emor. Vayetze ben isha Yisraelis, v'hu ben ish mitzri, mitoch b'nei Yisrael. A son of a Jewish mother, Egyptian father, went out, got into a fight. Vayetze ben isha Yisraeli, he got into a fight, and what happened? What was the fight about? Well, Rashi says there in his last opinion, Bo lita alo b'soch machane don. His mother came from the tribe of Don, so he wanted to pitch his tent, the blasphemer, in the tribe of Don. Amrulo, they said to him, Mativ cholakam, what are you doing here? You're not from the tribe of Don. Your father was an Egyptian. Nichnas leveis dino shel Moshe. So he went to ask a shayla to Moshe. Yotzu mechuyav. Moshe said, they're right. You have no connection to Don. Your father's not from Don. Your father's a Mitzri. Omad vegidev. So then he went and blasphemed. So he was considered a Jew. He wasn't just didn't have a tribe. The tribal connection was transmitted through the father because it was the father who inherited tribal lands. That was also why the daughters of Tzlofchad, for example, the end of Parshas Maaseh, could only marry within their tribe, Menashe. Otherwise, their husband from another tribe would have succeeded to the tribal land. And the Torah says, V'nigro nachal ason mi nachal asav osenu, is the complaint of Menashe. We'll lose out because the man from another tribe will then go back to his tribe, be the owner of the land. So they were commanded to marry within. The Chobas, Yoreshes Nachala, Mimatos B'nei Yisrael, Echad Mishpacha, Matei Avia, Tiel Isha. Any daughter that inherits, because there are no sons, she has to marry some from her tribe. Leman Yerushu B'nei Yisrael, Ish Nachlas Avosav. So tribal portions remain in the hands of the tribes. When the tribes were eventually permitted to intermarry, long after the conquest, and the distribution of the land was complete, it was a great festival that we still commemorate today. When do we celebrate that day? Tu B'Av. Yom Shehutra Shvatim Lovo Zebozeh. The Gemara in Tainis of Lamed Amud Beis. The day the tribes, during the period of the Shoftim, were permitted to intermarry, it was a great joy. The pool of eligible bachelors and bachelorettes expanded. Everybody was happy. So clearly tribal status, I mean, today it's relevant to Kohanim and Leviim, is conveyed by the father, but not Jewishness. Just the psukim in the Torah teach us that. The reform assumption that the biblical law was patrilineal and the rabbis later changed it reflects a flawed and distorted understanding of the sources, but flows naturally from their rejection of the divinity of the Torah. So they relied on scholars who posited theories. Scholars are great, you know, they're not bound to anyone, just write, say whatever they want. So one said, well, it's because paternity was unreliable. Another said, because the rabbis hated anything mixed, like shatnez or basar b'cholov. But that wouldn't explain why a Jewish mother and a non-Jewish father still conveys a Jewish status to the child. All right. The bottom line is that tribal status, yichus, comes from the father. Jewishness comes from the mother. And the psul, like a cholol or a mamzer, mamzerus, can come from either father or mother. This is really a simple distinction that they missed. There's a third methodological flaw that they made as well. Because from that error, they built an edifice with a flimsy foundation trying to explain the historical reasons for a shift. So, if indeed they maintain it used to be patrilineal, and then at some point it was changed, why was it changed? So, some trace it to Ezra's time, even to a parallel decision made around the time of Ezra by Pericles in Athens, who granted Athenian citizenship to the offspring of Athenian mothers, but not fathers. What's the connection? I don't know. But the desire to look for definitive reasons for any halacha is inherently hazardous and usually misguided. Halacha deals with a what, not a why. Why is philosophy, it's not halacha, usually plays little or no role to the true posek, but this is usually lost to people outside the Torah world. Why, in fact, do we embrace matrilineal descent? It's a different discussion. That's philosophy. Halacha is clear. So various reasons are offered by them, all rank speculation. Why the Jewish mother? Maybe the prevalence of rape, non-Jewish marauders, disappearing or unknown fathers, all to justify was to be the new practice of matrilineal descent. Now notice, Ezra already ordered his charges. This is a famous episode in the book of Ezra. Shechaniah ben Yechiel came to Ezra and said, we have trespassed against God. And we took foreign alien wives from the nations of the lands. Now is there hope for the Jewish people? Let's make a covenant to God, enact a covenant. To remove all those women and the children born to her with God's counsel, those who are charedim, those who tremble to do God's mitzvahs in the Torah, they will do it. Kum ki olecha davar v'nachri moch chazak v'asei. So in fact, they did. In Ezra's time, they came back to Israel, not many, but 42,000 or so came back, many intermarried. Wasn't working well for the polity. Ezra told them, convinced them to banish their non-Jewish wives and children, and they all did. How he convinced them is a lingering mystery. But no such corresponding mandate was issued to children of Jewish mothers and non-Jewish fathers. Why? They'd be Jewish. Of course, not likely that they went to Israel with Ezra anyway. But in any event, today amongst the non-Jews, according to halacha, status is conveyed according to the father, like before Sinai, not the mother. Countries actually differ as to how they grant automatic citizenships. America's changed over the time, and now the basic law is that an American citizen is a child of either a mother or a father who's an American citizen. That's why Ted Cruz, our good friend, for example, is an American citizen. Many hold eligible to run for president despite the fact that he was born in Canada, because his mother was an American citizen who lived in America for more than 10 years as per the Nationality Act of 1940. The reform maintained, without any compelling evidence that the law changed, and therefore they're just reviving the traditional, in fact, the ancient method of assigning status. But the arguments are bogus, just a rejection of Jewish tradition. Here's how they rationalized it. I quote, earlier the Mishnah, it's Yadayim, Perek Dalid, claimed that the various ethnic groups had been so intermingled by the invasion of Sancheirev that none of the prohibitions against marriage with neighboring people remained valid. In this instance, and others similar to them, we're dealing with clear biblical injunctions which have been revised by the rabbinic tradition. We have followed these examples in our 20th century revision. So this too is bogus. What are the words saying? What they're saying is because Bas Sancheirev, as the Mishnah says, an Ammoni came to marry, and the Basin said he can't, and then Rabbi Yeshua said no. V'chi Ammonim u'Moavim b'mkomonein. Are the people of Ammon and Moab still the same people as from the time of Tanakh? Kvar ola Sancheirev melech Ashur uvil belos kalumo. Sancheirev came and engaged in massive population transfers. So just because you're living in Moab, in Ammon, doesn't make you an Ammoni or Moavi for the purpose of the Torah. That's what we're talking about. If Sancheirev transferred populations, so Torah's decree no longer applies. It's not the place of Ammon or Moab, but the people of Ammon or Moab. Now they're unknown. But those are the laws of Psulei Chitun. They make it seem as since Bas Sancheirev uvil belos kalumos, so therefore that supersedes the prohibition of intermarriage. That can't be. Now they brought further proofs from the decisions of the courts and government of Israel, some of which we've discussed already this year. As we learned, the Israelis were determining who can be an Israeli citizen or eligible under the law of return. But of course, as we noted, who allowed them to determine who's Jewish? They could determine who's Israeli. But according to the Reform, if Israeli law allows the children, even grandchildren, of one Jew and does not distinguish between father, mother, grandmother, grandfather, then neither must the Reform movement. They base it on them. Other considerations as well. Additionally, since Reform recognizes civil marriages between Jews and non-Jews, they felt, I quote, morally obliged to make provisions for the offspring of such unions. Those were necessary for reasons of justice and compassion. Well, once you wrap your decision in morality, justice, and compassion, it's very hard to argue with that, because almost by definition, opponents will be immoral, unjust, and uncompassionate. And they recognize as well that after the emancipation, Jewish identity is more of, I quote, more of a private commitment than a legal status, leaving it a complex mix of destiny and choice. The bottom line is, it was driving many, what they saw as many potential Jews away from Judaism, and so it was done, an exercise in what the head of the HUC called constituency retention. They didn't want to drive anyone away. All right, now you'll recall that the Reform changed the rules completely and they required acts of identification. So even the child of a Jewish mother would not be considered Jewish mother only, non-Jewish father, would not be considered Jew unless he performed these appropriate, timely public acts, formal acts of identification of the Jewish faith and people. It was worded to allow maximum flexibility. If we thought bar mitzvah would be sufficient, that's true, but not completely true. The child must continue to identify as a Jew, do other acts that reaffirm Jewish identity, usually meant either going to classes or becoming a member of the temple. But one thing they categorically reject, and that is the child cannot be raised in two religions. You have to make a choice. So I came across this very interesting case in the CCAR 1998. I think it was in, I forget where. Somewhere in the South. Jewish father was married to a Baptist mother. Son went to Hebrew school, the Reform school, and every Sunday went to church with his mother. He was a bright kid. He was bar mitzvah in the temple. Bless you. Father was very active in the temple, so every year they gave him Maftar Yonah, every Yom Kippur. But because the father doesn't read Hebrew, so he read the Maftar in English, the son did read Hebrew, having gone through the Hebrew school, so he would recite the brachos before and after the Haftarah. When the son turned 17, he was baptized as a Christian. He began to study to become a Baptist minister, nachas for his mother. The question the father raised is, can he continue to recite the Haftarah in shul, the brachos of the Haftarah? And the father wanted him to do it, because that was connection to the Jewish people. Oh, what a shiloh, they ask. Can the non-Jew recite this? So the CCR ruled unequivocally no. And they said he should not have even had a bar mitzvah, because you can't have both. Now, at the bar mitzvah, apparently, he committed not to be baptized for at least 2 years. And the Reform rabbi said, no, that's not sufficient. That's not enough. You cannot perform acts of identification with the Jewish people while being part of another faith. Church attendance nullifies any Jewish connection. The same will be true, by the way, if his mother was Jewish and he accompanied his father to church. Be the exact same thing. According to the Reform, even use this word, this young man is an apostate, because at one time he had a bar mitzvah. He said the brachos. Now he's becoming a Baptist minister. He's an apostate. In effect, that's the only limit. You can do anything and nothing, but you can't act like a Christian. That's how the Reform movement was trying, to avoid the pitfall of the Paul and the Gentile scenario I noted earlier. Now, the consequences of this decision are still being felt today. So what was the reaction? By the way, I looked. I didn't see any great uproar in the Reform movement over this. It seems that was just embraced naturally, very little dissent, if any. The Torah world expected very little from Reform and treated this decision accordingly. Besides the mangling of halacha, it was perceived as a flagrant act of disunity, shattering the ties that bind Jews. Rabbi Bleich said at the time, I quote, "It's tantamount to renunciation of the already tenuous ties which bind Reform Jews to other members of the Jewish faith community." Others compared it explicitly to the retracing of the steps of Paul, Saul of Tarsus, in opening up Judaism to the Gentiles. I understand there's a lingering sense after the Holocaust that no one wants to drive any Jew, any potential Jew, away. And I think that stopped most people from just declaring Reform Judaism just another religion. But clearly, patrilineal descent was considered to be a self-marginalizing decision, with Reform Judaism writing itself out of the Jewish people to the distress of everyone else. The conservatives were especially unhappy with the decision. Robert Gordas said the obvious. It was driven by the intermarriage statistics, as Jews were being drained away. In essence, if they won't join you, so join them. The big loser, someone wrote, was Jewish women, as Jewish men would now be even less inclined to marry Jews, since a Jewish mother was no longer necessary for Jewish identity. And in fact, those were the results. Swept under the rug at the time, and thenceforth, was this dilemma. The conservatives have always maintained a joint non-Orthodox front with the Reform and clamored for acceptance, legitimacy, recognition of conversions in Israel. They still do. But notwithstanding, the conservatives do not yet, I hope they don't ever, accept patrilineal descent, nor do they accept Reform conversions. I once was asked by a conservative rabbi at a public forum, why don't I recognize non-Orthodox conversions? And I answered him with a question. What would you do if a Reform convert came to your temple, wanted to marry someone from your temple? And he answered that he would require conversion, because they don't accept Reform conversion, to which I said, then you're just like me, except my standards are higher and my standards are core with halacha. We both don't accept Reform conversions. That undermines all their activism, all their public protests, but rarely do you see them make that distinction in public. There's an expectation that over time the conservatives will accept patrilineal descent. That's been the course. I'm surprised it hasn't happened, but I'm gratified that it hasn't happened. And in fact, it was explicitly ruled out twice already as against halacha. Secondly, consequences. For Reform, this was in fact the seal of approval for intermarriage, because thenceforth it made no difference whether you married a Jew or a non-Jew, as Jewish identity was very fluid. And the numbers since then reflect the sad reality, with almost three quarters of Reform Jews marrying out. It's hard to ascertain clear data because the questions are not asked directly, they're very personal. But in the recent Pew study, roughly 700,000 Jews in America identify as Reform Jews. Of them, estimates are anywhere from 20% to 33% are not Jews according to halacha. That is a devastating figure. And generally, Jewish women who intermarry first sought out Jewish men to a greater degree than did Jewish men who intermarry, who the polls show express a greater disregard for the religious affiliation of the person they marry. So those men were already less engaged in their Jewishness, and the patrilineal descent decision was designed to save them with minimal success. They're still, according to the studies, far less engaged. Despite the decision, still today, offspring of Jewish fathers are much less likely to claim a Jewish identity when they are in college. And the fathers themselves, according to the studies, do not really care about raising their children as Jews. They just don't want them to be Christians. They're happy basically the way they are, with nothing. Thus, 61% of families, Jewish father, non-Jewish mother, 61% do not give their male children a bris milah. Conversely, when the mother's Jewish and the father's not, 69% of the mothers arrange a bris milah. All this from a 2013 study for the Jewish People Policy Institute. This was by Sylvia Barak Fishman. So obviously these days, any Reform Jew becoming a Baal Tshuva, seeking to marry in the Torah world, is scrutinized very carefully. Non-Jewishness is that pervasive, and fidelity to Jewish law is not at all of value. Sadly, we have already become two peoples. You know, in some Reform temples, most of the member families are intermarried, in some temples. And the changes in the Reform movement are palpable. It just occurred to me the other day, you know, Reform originally was an anti-Zionist movement, only changed after 1948, but now they're reverting to the most far-left, J Street-like discomfort with Jewish nationalism. In fact, when J Street was not allowed to enter the President's Conference, the reaction of Rick Jacobs, heads of the Reform movement today, was, well, we're going to pull out also. Well, why would that be? So I speculate. Is it because of the influx of non-Jews or partial Jews in the Reform movement, which gives them a less compelling Jewish identity and really less identification with the Jewish state? I wouldn't be surprised if a large percentage of the so-called Jewish anti-Israel activists on campuses are from the Reform movement and products of intermarriages, because their Jewish identity is much less meaningful to them. Conversely, Birthright routinely accepts patrilineal descent Jews for their free trip to Israel. So that is the advantage of enhancing the Jewish identity, but has the disadvantage of other Jewish participants thinking they're actually Jewish. Now, realizing this and other problems, in recent years, the Reform movement has again begun to attempt to interest the non-Jewish spouse in conversion as part of what they call outreach. But this has been extremely controversial. It's an insult, it's held to be, to a generation raised with patrilineal descent and has not been widely embraced, even conceding that Reform conversion is itself unacceptable, according to halacha. There are Reform rabbis who encourage marrying Jews, in marrying, who've been lambasted by their membership. The last couple of years, it's a temple in Marlboro, New Jersey. Rabbi spoke on Yom Kippurim. What a statistic. Only 10% of the grandchildren of intermarried couples, whatever stripe, however you crunch male, female, Jewish, not Jewish, only 10% of the grandchildren of the intermarried identify as Jews. On Yom Kippur, Drasha Kol Nidre, he offered to pay for a 6-month subscription to J-Date for any interested young person in the shul, in the temple. Some parents were happy, took him up on the offer. Others were outraged by the sermon and attacked him because the implication was that there's something wrong with intermarriage. And how dare he suggest that 30 years or 25 years after this decision in 1983. Well, that is a downward spiral to extinction. I have to tell you that I've met some of these children who grew up with a Jewish identity, some of those that do, and I've converted about a dozen of them over the years, all today Shomrei Torah and Mitzvos. And what's easy about it, if the father is dominant, the Jewish father is dominant, and especially the child has a Jewish last name, Goldberg, Schwartz, etc., so they see themselves as Jews. And in the non-Jewish milieu, school, high school, college, in which they circulate, they're perceived as Jews. Many of them don't even realize they're not Jews until they encounter Orthodox Jews. But because the Jewish identity is so strong, it's easier to convert them in that sense than someone coming just from the outside. As one famous authority has even ruled that Batei Din should convert such children even without Kabbalas HaMitzvos, if the father requested. This was the opinion of a former Sephardi chief rabbi of Israel, Rav Meir Ben Sion Chai Uziel, writes a number of tshuvos. Here, Piskei Uziel B'Shalot Hazman Siman Samech Dalid, and this is a something that he, I won't say innovated, but he popularized. Da'af Agav Shunikra B'no Shel Anochris, even though this child is considered the child of a non-Jewish woman, Eino Yotze Michlal Zera Yisrael. He has Jewish seed. He's not outside the framework of Zera Yisrael. Think of that concept. It sounds strange because, yeah, there's no Kiddush in Tovsin. He has the genes, or she has the genes of the father. But what do genes have to do with anything? No. He maintains Zera Yisrael is also something. The fact the father is Jewish gives them a certain attachment to the Jewish people. And then in Siman Samech Hei, the next Siman, he says, Mikol Mokom Livnehem, Vaday She'anu Chayavim LeKarvam, these children, we have an obligation to bring them near to us, Mekarv them, Lo Mebayim Heim B'nei Yisrael L'Shabonehem Yisrael Gemurim, and not just those from intermarriages where the mother is Jewish, El Afiluim Heim B'nei Goya, even if their mother is not Jewish, Hare Mizera Yisrael Heima, they're from the seed of Israel. Ve'elahem b'vchinat son ovdos. They're just considered lost sheep. You have to bring them back. I have to tell you, that's a minority opinion. It's, again, the only relaxation is that with times we've even shortened the process if someone's already Shomer Torah Mitzvos because they identify with the Jewish people. Some are going to shul for years. They just saw themselves as Jews from birth. But it's a minority opinion that without Kabbalas HaMitzvos, we should accept them, and therefore it's not widely practiced, although on the left-wing fringe of Orthodoxy, they want to revive Harav Uziel's opinion. In any event, Reform Judaism remains a slippery slope to complete assimilation, and the patrilineal descent decision was and is a catastrophe for all of Klal Yisrael. Sad to say, you can't put the genie back in the bottle, but we can only hope that the conservatives never follow suit and that we can do our share to save whatever souls we can for God, for Torah, and for Klal Yisrael. I thank you all very much, and thank you all for your participation this year.